Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Julia Hartley Brewer Podcast.
Ruthless but fair. Julia Hartley Brewer.
Comprehensive coverage of all the news stories that matter to you.
Harder, older, Hartley Brewer.
The Julia Hartley Brewer Podcast from Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, welcome back to the show. I'm Julia Hartley Brewer and you are with Talk TV. In just a couple of moments, we'll be bringing your exclusive Talk TV interview with Liz Truss. But still with me in the studio is editor at Spiked Online, Tom Slater. I wanted to bring some breaking news to you, everybody, and get your thoughts on it, Tom. Police in Brussels have moved to shut down an ongoing gathering of what Politico are calling Europe's hard right elite. It includes Nigel Farage, Miriam Cates, Tory MP, Suella Braverman, our former Home Secretary, and also Matthew Goodwin, who's a political academic. But the National Conservatism Conference, also, by the way, welcoming Liz Truss today, was set to welcome the Hungarian leader, again, whether you agree with him or not, democratically elected Viktor Orban, over the next few days. But law enforcement arrived 2 hours into the event in Brussels to inform organisers the event would be terminated because of the possibility of public disorder. I mean, this is extraordinary in a, you know, I mean, heart of Europe, heart of, you know, democratic EU, ha, 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 shutting down a debate and a conference because people think there might be violence.
It's absolutely outrageous. And you know that's all spurious. They just don't agree with this conference. They don't like some of the people
I'm
who are invited
calling them hard
to it.
Right. I mean, sorry, is Miriam Cates? Is there a problem?
Yeah,
I mean,
noted fascist Miriam Cates, Tory
hard,
MP, you know.
Hard right.
This is the problem, isn't it? It's the fact that because there is this sort of demonisation of anyone outside of a certain orthodoxy, they suddenly get labelled this. It's perfectly fine for anyone in the authorities in Brussels or in polite society to disagree with some of the people invited to this conference. There's some on that list who, you know, I certainly wouldn't agree on with many issues. But that's not the point. You allow people to speak. You allow people to meet. You don't demonise people by throwing labels.
But also, if someone is threatening violence, we're assuming from the left, okay, who else is going to be threatening violence against this hard right, inverted commas, conference? Then you should deal with that. And it's the same as people being cancelled because they want to talk on trans issues at a university. If activists on one side are threatening it, you draft in more police.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's obviously just a flimsy pretext and it's just a reminder that you can't trust the supposedly liberal elites with freedom of speech. They're dreadful.
You absolutely can't, indeed. Tom Slater, thank you very much. Well, let's move on. Now, earlier in a Talk TV exclusive, I spoke to a former Prime Minister, Liz Truss, apparently hard right, according to this, where she shares her thoughts on her failed premiership, the Rwanda plan, Donald Trump, and whether Keir Starmer really believes that women can have a penis or not. This was all on a publicity tour for her brand new book, partly a memoir, partly her thoughts on the future of the country, 10 years to save the West. Well, I started off by asking her about her premiership. The first question I need to ask you really is, 49 days you were Prime Minister, you were facing huge amounts of criticism, mockery, the Daily Star, had, you know,
I don't read that paper.
But everyone else suddenly did, didn't they? We had the letters. Did the letters or Liz Truss, would they last the longest? Question, looking back on it all now, after you've written the memoirs, would it have been better to have been the Prime Minister, the best Prime Minister we never had in some people's minds, than to have served just 49 days and left office under the circumstances you did? Do you regret becoming Prime Minister?
I mean, sometimes I do think, was I just facing an impossible task? And given the policies I wanted to pursue, cutting taxes, getting the economy going, doing things like fracking, you know, making Britain successful, getting out of our stagnation, was it actually possible to deliver those given the massive resistance from the economic establishment, but also the fact that not enough Conservative MPs were frankly prepared to back those types of policies? I do think that. But then I think, well, if I hadn't tried, would I regret it now? And I just think in politics, you know, I never thought Boris Johnson should have been deposed. I thought it was a massive mistake. And I was not desperate to put myself forward. I just felt, I felt compelled to, because I felt there were serious issues that we needed to deal with as a country and as a party, and they just weren't being put forward by the other people. So
you don't regret it. Would you do it again?
Yes.
You would.
I'm the kind of person, Julia, you know, in a room, if nobody's putting their hand up, I put my hand up.
Right.
And it's my nature. So, you know, do I regret the way it turned out? Of course I do. Do I think I was in an impossible position? Yes, I do, just given the level of resistance. These are, you know, my conclusion in the book is we need to build a much more powerful conservative movement and infrastructure who are prepared to be brave to take on, you know, what is now a very strong leftist establishment. And we can see that in every area, from net zero to wokery to the economy. You know, the left have been in the ascendant. And, you know,
Tony Blair left office, but left pretty much all of his appointees in every quango running pretty
but
everywhere.
He also created
every national
quangos.
Institution.
He created quangos. You know, he created the Supreme Court, you know, which is now stopping the government implementing perfectly legitimate immigration policy. So we did not do enough to get rid of that Blairite sludge, which is now stopping us doing anything. And, you know, I tried to take them on.
You did try to take them on.
I got thoroughly trashed for trying to do it.
In your memoir, you've talked about how, you know, you was up against the Bank of England, the Office for Budget Responsibility, the civil service. I mean, this entire institution, many in the media, as you point out, many in your own party, including, you know, senior figures in the party who were opposed to what you were doing. Is that just a conspiracy theory, or was it maybe the policies that you were putting forward that were wrong? Was it the style in which you put them forward? Were there mistakes that you made? For instance, people say, you know, you put a cabinet together where you basically said, if you didn't support me early on, tough, you aren't part of it. You didn't build a coalition, you didn't communicate properly. Is it all their fault, or did you take any of the blame?
So, first of all, on the subject of the cabinet, I had lots of my opponents in the leadership election in the cabinet, such as Kemi Badenoch and Penny Mordaunt. So I don't think it's fair to say it was a cabinet of true trust believers. I mean, the problem is, after 12 years in power, there were quite a lot of people who felt that they should be in the cabinet. Yep. And you can't please everybody, to say the very least, which is certainly a lesson I learned. I learned the hard way as prime minister. But I don't think there were easy decisions of that kind to make. I mean, my view is that the policies were right. You know, absolutely, that
you stand raising, by. You stand by all the policies, 45p tax cuts.
I stand by all of them. Mm-hmm. I believe that if those policies have been in place, and actually this has been confirmed by a number of, you know, free market economists, if those policies had been in place, Britain would be in a better position now. Our energy would be cheaper if we'd got on with fracking. You know, we'd be attracting more corporations to the UK if we'd kept corporation tax low. Look at what's happened since. You know, we have seen continued economic stagnation because that economic consensus hasn't been taken on. Now, I said this in the leadership election, I'm not the slickest presenter. I've never claimed to be that. Did I have the political infrastructure ready to step into number 10? No, I didn't. And what frankly horrified me, Julia, was just the lack of support in general.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Just practical support in terms of, you talked about,
shopping,
and some of the experts, getting a food delivery.
I know. This goes back to the point about it was a mistake for the Conservative Party to get rid of Boris for many reasons, but it is very hard to take over midterm mm-hmm. with a bold agenda to change things.
Was it the timing then, to a certain extent? Because we were coming out of COVID, coming out of lockdown, but in the situation where the country was reeling, I mean, emotionally, but that actually people weren't ready for that, and it was the wrong time, and perhaps coming in and just trying to get everything back on an even keel post Boris Johnson would have been the right solution at that time. Or
but
did
if
you
that
feel
was the
that
right solution,
first 100 days, I've got to get everything
if
done?
If that was the right solution, I was the wrong person, because I'm not somebody who wanted to become prime minister to be prime minister and do nothing. I felt that people had voted for change in 2016 when they voted for Brexit. They voted for change again in 2019 when they voted for Boris. I felt we hadn't done enough of that change, you know, whether it's the EU laws still being on the statute books, which they are. It's not getting on with some of the trade deals we should be doing, not getting on with the things like fracking, which would help deliver. You know, so I felt things needed to change.
We were in a quagmire.
Fundamentally. And this is what I said all this during the leadership campaign. You know, we've had a long period of stagnation. Why are people frustrated? People are frustrated because their cost of living is going up, and yet their income isn't going up as much as their cost of living. And ultimately, if you want to win an election, I believe it's about the fundamentals. It's not... People don't really register what press release Downing Street puts out. What they care about is, you know, what are my bills?
Yeah.
Have I got good opportunities? Is my kid's school telling me, you know, that there's 100 genders, whatever? Yeah. You know, that's what But that's what people care about. And I wanted to change the fundamentals. And the biggest problem, I don't think, was public perception. I think it is the fact that the, you know, and it's not a conspiracy. I'm not saying it's conspiracy. I'm saying it's groupthink. There's establishment groupthink in this country. It reflected in what the Treasury and the OBR and the Bank of England think, which is Britain can't really grow that fast. You know, we've got to raise taxes. Big government's a good thing. The government basically makes decisions better than people do. You know, we need to keep close to the EU. We don't really want to change our laws. We don't really want to get tough on China because, you know, and that is the mentality. And what I really discovered in number 10 is trying to shift that mentality, you know.
It wasn't going to happen there and then.
It wasn't going to happen.
You thought the country needed fundamental change, but for some reason you think that Boris Johnson was the right man to remain in office. When, you know, he's been pro net zero, he's pro mass immigration. What did you think would have changed under Boris Johnson?
Boris and I don't agree on everything. And in particular, I think China is something we don't agree on. And also net zero is something we don't agree on. But he does believe in lower taxes. We discussed that when I was foreign secretary and trade secretary. He does want to see a dynamic economy. He does want to see deregulation. And you know, people had voted for him. I think a democratic mandate is really important. And you've got to have a very good reason for getting rid of a leader midstream.
You've brought up net zero a few times. In talking about growth, I've often interviewed the Secretary of State who claims to be for, you know, energy security and net zero. And I've always pointed out it's an either or, it's not an and. You can't be in favour of both. Back in August 2022 at the hustings for the leadership election that you did win, you told me, I support net zero by 2050. Now, you went on to say that there are lots of provisos, better ways of delivering it and making it more efficient, more flexible, based on an enterprise economy. Net zero is one of the main reasons why we are not energy sufficient, energy secure, why we've had the massive, massive hike in energy prices that were one of the reasons why your government was brought down, why America's doing just fine economically and why we're not. How can you look me in the eye and say, I support net zero by 2050 and still claim to be pro-growth?
Well, I don't support it anymore.
So what's changed since 2022?
Well, I've been convinced by your arguments, Julia.
Well, I should have. If more politicians listened to me, then we'd be in a much better place in this country.
So what?
You said categorically you supported it.
Well, I did.
And what changed? What new facts have come out?
Well, first of all, I supported it. I also wanted to get on with fracking. But when I look in more detail about what has happened, I think that it was the legislation to put it in. So I'm all for making the environment cleaner. Yeah. I'm happy with renewables, provided they compete in the open market. And you know, there's nothing wrong with trying to decarbonize the economy. I think what's wrong is the way we've put it into law. And that law is essentially constraining people's opportunities, you know, whether it's on maintaining a gas boiler or whether it's on driving a vehicle. And you know, to some extent at that time, and this is true on various policy areas, I was trying to appeal to a broad range of people in the Conservative Party.
Yep.
And now, you know, frankly,
no, I'm
saying...
Not.
Well, no, now I don't have to keep Conservative MPs on board, which is a pretty tough
So you didn't really
challenge.
Believe it when you said it?
Well, I believed in net zero to 2050. I did say I wanted to change things to make it easier to get to. I think I would be more... I've moved on it. In the same
we
way...
We should prioritise economic growth.
Actually moved on a number of issues because... And I think this is the journey many Conservatives have been on, that initially things like the Equality Act or the Climate Change Act, they sound like nice things, don't they? You know, who could be against the environment? Who could be against equality, Julia? But when you look at the real real effect it's had on the ability for government to get things done or the real costs it's had for people, then, yes, you have to be prepared to think
again. But again, OK, the Equality Act was 2010, but again, we had, last time I looked at a Tory government for 14 years that could have made changes to that, a Tory government that enacted, enshrined under Theresa May in 2019, net zero by 2050 in law. I mean, so many of the problems that we've got right now are actually as a result of Conservative policies or Conservatives failing to turn back the clock or changing policies which are in place which are causing those problems. Is that the sort of blob groupthink that you're fighting against?
So we have made, you know, we have made some good changes. So whether it was education reform, I think our education system is much better. Brexit itself, the trade deals we did, standing up for Ukraine. So, but you are right in that we did not do enough to turn around the Blair legacy. And that has fundamentally stymied us from pursuing the policies that we ought to be pursuing. And we've also given too much ground to the extreme left, because what happens is, in one minute, it's we need to do more on climate change. The next minute is, right, you're not allowed to drive a car or have a boiler.
Yeah.
And there was too much appeasement of those leftist arguments. And I think, I say in my book, I think the environment is the biggest area we've lost the argument on. Mm-hmm. And we now need to win the argument back for free market environmental policies, not these top-down status policies. So, and what was my personal role in that? Well, on some of it, I got it right. So on gender self-ID, I stopped that. Even though there was a lot of pressure in Parliament to do that, I stopped it. On other areas, you know, maybe I as well went along with too many of these things.
You went along with lockdown, didn't you? I don't remember you ever speaking out against lockdown as a freedom fighter.
I spoke out within any cabinet meetings I was actually invited to talk about it, because quite a lot of the decisions were not made by cabinet.
Did you think that any of the lockdown decisions were wrong?
Well, definitely later on. I mean, to be honest, I was so shell-shocked, as I think a lot of people were, by what was happening. I didn't really know. I mean, I was trade secretary trying to do trade deals, and I was literally watching TV and Boris Johnson announced it. I didn't know anything about it. So,
which tells us another problem with that complete lack of cabinet government that we've seen over the last years. Let me come on to some of the policies.
I think you might find from my book that cabinet government is a bit of a myth.
Yeah, well, it certainly is these days, that's for sure. Let's talk about some of the policies that are around right now. Rwanda plan, votes in Parliament this week. We're going to see realistically by Friday the safety of Rwanda bill going into law. First of all, do you think we're actually going to see any channel migrants on a flight to Rwanda at any point this year or ever? And B, do you think that that policy will have any deterrent effect on channel migrants?
So I do hope that we will see that, but I certainly couldn't guarantee that from what I know about the situation. I mean, what we know is a perfectly legitimate government policy, which was developed under Boris Johnson, has been thwarted by the courts. And that is a huge problem for our democracy. And I've talked about how I don't think the Supreme Court should even exist. I think it's a Blairite creation.
What's wrong with the Supreme Court? We've got the High Court, we've got the Appeal Court. Having the highest court in the land be the Supreme Court as opposed to a court in a foreign land.
Well, I don't support a court in a foreign land either. But I think pre-2005, we had a Lord Chancellor who sat in cabinet who was responsible for the appointment of senior judges. Mm-hmm. And we had a democratically accountable system. We now don't have that. And that, to me, is a problem. And so I do support leaving the ECHR. But I don't think it's enough. I think if we don't sort out our domestic legal system, we will still have a problem with activist judges and lefty lawyers. I think that is a reality. So on Rwanda, yeah. I do think if the if we can implement the policy, it will work. I think the difficulty has been actually getting the policy implemented.
Again, putting
it's a bit like what I was saying about the mini budget. I think if those policies in place, they would work. The problem I had was getting them implemented.
But again, if you're talking about a few hundred Channel migrants ending up in Rwanda, I mean, most Channel migrants who've taken the odds, played the odds of getting across the Channel, one of those, you know, dangerous, busy routes across the sea, they're going to take the odds of whether or not they get sent to Rwanda. This isn't the same as the Australia policy, where you never set foot in Australia, end of story.
I mean, I think that for the longer term, we need to develop that type of relationship with more countries apart from Rwanda. I think we need to look at other solutions, but
selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I certainly, looking at it at the time, and I was foreign secretary, when it was introduced, I felt it was a step in the right direction to providing that deterrent effect that doesn't exist at the moment. And I think it's interesting that the system or the establishment or whatever you want to call them are fighting hammer and tongs against it. They're fighting hammer and tongs against it.
And a policy that's very popular with voters.
Why are they doing that? Probably because they know it will work.
Okay.
That's why they're doing it.
Is there any political will that you could detect among the Conservative Party, or indeed this government under Rishi Sunak, for the Rwanda policy to work to thwart Channel migrants? Rishi Sunak said, you know, one of my five pledges, I'll stop the boats. No one thinks he's going to stop the boats. The numbers have come up, have gone up in the last few months compared to the same time last year. Do you believe there is actually any honest, you know, in their hearts, political will to deal with this issue?
I think there is a fundamental problem that there are too many Conservative MPs who don't support changing our institutions, don't support leaving the ECHR, don't support the type of change I'm talking about to our judicial system that is actually going to restore democratic accountability. I think that is the problem. And it's an issue I faced with some of the policies I was pursuing that I simply didn't feel that I actually had a parliamentary majority to put those policies through. So we spent a lot of time in the Conservative Party talking about who our leader should be, about a disproportionate amount of time. But actually, if you don't have enough MPs,
had a majority of what, 60 plus at the time,
but
ostensibly on paper?
There are plenty of people who publicly will not support leaving the HR. ECHR will not support, you know, changing our court system. Who won't challenge.
Why do you think
they won't challenge the leftist drift
why
of our institutions?
Won't they? Is it because they want to go? I always say the same. Do they just want to go to the right dinner parties?
Yeah, they
want
to go
back
to these dinner parties. You know, the mythical.
Do you get invited to these?
Well, no, I don't. I actually managed to offend some people because I said I didn't get invited to these London dinner parties. I say, Liz, you've been round for dinner at my house. It's like, that's not the type of London dinner party I'm talking about.
This is about being thought of as a nice person on social media.
It's a nice person. It's, you know, do you get a position on a corporate board? You know, are you socially acceptable to the sort of general media, corporate, political class in London? And by the way, those people's view is very, very different from the view of my constituents in Norfolk, I can tell you. The opposite. But there is a groupthink around that stuff.
Well, coming up after the break, part two of my interview with Liz Truss about her position on many things, including trans ideology. You don't want to miss it. I'm Julia Hartley-Brewer. You're with Talk TV.
One of the things that you didn't get into in terms of the groupthink and where you did stand firm, and as a woman, I'm very grateful to you, is on the trans issue and gender self-ID and standing up for women's, not just identity, but safety and privacy as well. Kemi Badenoch, still in government, of course, has talked about how the woke capture of British institutions has meant that actually even after the CAS report last week on the Tavistock and children being transitioned, having their bodies mutilated, I mean, absolutely horrific stuff that's been going on, that actually the trans capture is still so strong. And people have shown cowardice. They need to show more bravery in speaking out. When you were, one of your roles as Women's and Equalities Minister, you stopped gender self-ID. What did you know then, which your colleagues say, like, I don't know, Penny Mordaunt, who said on the floor of the House of Commons, trans women are women, and Gillian Keegan, now Education Secretary, who has said in letters, trans women are women. What did you know that they don't know?
Well, I looked at the issues from first principles, and it seemed to me obvious that you can't change your sex. You don't need a PhD in biology to understand that. And it was clear then that there were, I mean, I think it was around that time the Keira Bell case was coming out, but it was clear that children were being misled, were being given puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones that would damage their future fertility, you know, their future, you know, body. And I just thought that was appalling. And what I remember at the time is I had lots of meetings with the LGBT lobby, the likes of Stonewall, and they were sort of saying to me, well, you know, these children will be suicidal if it doesn't happen, et cetera, et cetera. They were trying to use emotional blackmail, and I reacted viscerally to that because the role of a government minister is to do the right thing, not to give in to that type of pressure. And I think with our institutions, the problem is that because they're not directly democratically accountable, they don't feel the same relationship with the public and understand what the public's views of these things are. And they just become very easily influenceable by these very powerful lobbies. So what Stonewall do is they say, if you don't go along with our ideology, if you don't do this with your loos at your school or your university or your corporate, you won't be on our list of LGBT-friendly
employers.
You and
I would say, who cares?
Yeah, we might say, who cares? But that had become a badge of honour.
Yeah.
You know, and it's part of this sort of social signalling that goes on amongst a particular group of people. And I'm increasingly hearing from constituents on the doorstep, people are saying, I know I shouldn't say this, but...
Yeah.
Or I could be arrested for expressing this view, however. And people, like, really feel this sort of sense of these things not being acceptable. And I think that's very powerful. And you have to be quite brave to stand up to that and say, I am prepared to be reviled. And, of course, J.K. Rowling is the ultimate example of somebody who's just been prepared to tell these people to get stuffed.
Yeah.
But it's...
And been proven to be right. Do you think the other politicians, the Keir Starmers, who think that apparently 99.9% of women don't have a penis, but this other 0.1%, which is thousands, I think it's about 30,000 women apparently do, do you think they actually believe the stuff they say?
No, they don't. I don't believe for a minute that Keir Starmer thinks that there are any women who have a penis.
Why do they say
it? Of course he doesn't. Because
why do so many on your side?
Because he's
that?
Under intense pressure from the left of the Labour Party. You can see this, and it's the same is true with the Democrats in the US. These extremists who believe in gender ideology, or they believe in, they're extremely, they believe in supporting Hamas or whatever, they're constantly pushing to occupy and bring, and he is trying to compromise with those people. And my message to all of these politicians, including Starmer, indeed some Conservatives, is you can't compromise with people who don't believe in biology.
Yeah, that's it's not negotiation.
It's like you can't compromise with somebody who believes in terrorism. There isn't a halfway.
You've led us very nicely to the issue of what's going on in the Middle East. We have seen over the weekend, of course, the Iranian attack on Israel, more than 101 drones and missiles intercepted, thankfully, largely without injury to people in Israel, and expected retaliation from Israel. Is the West up to the fight with the existential fight that we are facing with Islamist extremists in the Middle East? Are we up to that fight, US, UK, France and others?
We need to do more. We absolutely need to do more.
Do we have the backbone?
And it's not the Islamist fight is also linked to Russia. It's linked to China. We know that China is circumventing the sanctions on Iran. We know that Hamas went to Russia. So this is a group of countries that want to undermine Western civilization.
An axis of evil?
Yeah, it's an axis of evil. They want to undermine Western civilization, and we are not treating them like that. In the 80s, Reagan called out the USSR as the evil empire. We don't hear that type of rhetoric from Biden. In fact, he's been trying to do a deal with Iran on, resuscitating the JCPOA. And Janet Yellen was in China recently. So, no, I don't think we're spending enough on defence right across Europe and America. And I also think we're not understanding the nature of the threat. The nature of the threat is they want to end our way of life.
Most people in the West, I don't think, get that. And we see that with these, when we're dealing with Gaza, we see people on the streets every other Saturday in London, perhaps not understanding.
Well, I fear some of those people want to undermine our way of life as well. It's not a surprise that these ideologies are linked. Mm-hmm. Support for Hamas, support for extreme, eco solutions, support for the woke transgender agenda. I mean, amazingly, because they're all contradictory. But what they're all about is saying there's something fundamentally bad about British culture and society. There's something fundamentally bad about American and culture and society. We should be somehow ashamed of it. Mm. And by the way, there are these so-called freedom fighters over here. So these things are linked, in my view. The sort of rotting from within and the threat from without. So in order to deal with it, we need to get our own act together.
Will the world be a safer place after November the 5th this year with President Trump back in the Oval Office or President Biden remaining there?
It will be safer with President Trump.
Why?
And I hope he gets elected.
Why?
Well, let's look at the evidence. Let's look at what happened when Trump was president. And I've been in cabinet for both the Trump and the Biden presidencies. And you didn't have Putin's aggression in Ukraine. You didn't have this, he took a very tough line on China. And he took a very tough line on Iran in terms of withdrawing from the nuclear deal and putting on sanctions. And I think what we're seeing now is the result of the fact that there has been too much appeasement of these regimes. And I believe Trump would stop that appeasement.
OK. Let's bring things back home to the UK. We've also got a general election likely to be this year. There's some talk of a July election now. I know, you rolled your eyes. Exactly the same as the general British public also doing so.
My money's on November.
November.
And okay. I think that would be best for everyone concerned.
When you say best for everyone concerned, do the Conservatives deserve to win the next election?
Yes, we do. Well, I think we could do more to deserve to win it even more. by being clear about what we need to do, such as leaving the ECHR, such as taking a stronger stance on things like net zero, such as passing my private members bill to stop puberty blockers and gender, cross-gender hormones. So I think there are more things we could do. But fundamentally, what Keir Starmer would do is turbocharge all of these problems we've been talking about. You know, the overpowerful leftist bureaucrats would be empowered by Keir Starmer. The
might
lawyers,
have an opposition for a change. Should be quite
the
nice.
The lawyers,
wouldn't it?
Sorry,
might have an opposition for a change if the Tories are ousted. That'd be nice.
Well, he is in the opposition at the moment, and he's not. I don't think he's convincing the public, and I think it would be very bad news for Britain if he got in. Now, would I like us to do more? Would I like us to take a stronger stand on these issues? Yes, I would, which is exactly what I'm advocating in my book. But certainly, you know, if people think that Keir Starmer is the answer, I don't know what they think the question is. They've got no idea about why the country has had very little economic growth for the past 25 years. They've got no analysis at all.
I think the answer would be we haven't had enough immigrants. I think that would be the answer. We need to have more. Can I ask you, if you had a choice between Keir Starmer in number 10 and Nigel Farage, perhaps going back to lead Reform UK, things, we see strange things happen in elections in the last few years, in number 10, who would you prefer? You were, of course, at Nigel Farage's 6-year birthday
party.
Yeah,
I wasn't invited. Keir Starmer has never invited me to his party.
I'm really shocked to hear that. And no doubt shocking for you as well. Who would you prefer?
Well,
if you had a choice
clearly,
between those
like,
two?
I would like Nigel Farage to join the Conservative Party. I clearly think Nigel Farage has got better ideas than Keir Starmer.
But
the reality is the choice is between Conservatives and Labour at the election. But I've been very clear that I think Nigel Farage should join the Conservative
Would you have
party.
Had him as perhaps a US, you know, ambassador to the United States?
I'm not sure that would be a particularly good use of his talents.
Is there a route back to government for you? We've seen, you know, William Hague return from Tory leader to go on to obviously to be Foreign Secretary. I mean, Ian Duncan Smith, of course, when he was Tory leader, went on. OK, he wasn't Prime Minister. David Cameron, Prime Minister, back, I think, much to everyone's surprise, as Foreign Secretary.
I'm actually enjoying the freedom of being able to say what I really think.
Why can't you say what you really think in government? Isn't that
because
part of the problem
tied,
of our politics?
You're tied by collective responsibility, but also you've got a 24-hour media which is totally focused on gotcha, and anything you say can be used in evidence against you the whole time. And from where I am now, I can say what I think in a much more free way. And My frustration with British political debate is it is very superficial. There's an awful lot of focus on who's the party leader or, you know, who's up and who's down. And there are some really serious things that have gone wrong in this country. And, you know, the economy isn't growing enough. We've got this huge sort of woke problem that is infecting everything from sports teams to schools. You know, we've got an immigration issue that the government is trying to be solved, but is being blocked by the courts. And
no, the government isn't being blocked by the courts. We had 745,000 people given
visas.
Well,
that's true. That's a
they were legal visas.
That's the legal. I agree. We need to do more on that as well. But my point is, very little bandwidth seems to be going into discussing how do we do those fundamental changes. And my heart, I'm a Democrat. People voted for change twice, and we need to deliver it. And the political class or whatever you want to call them needs to wake up.
One of the things you mentioned and you talk about in your memoir, I say 10 Years to Save the West, out today, is about the lack of support in number 10 as Prime Minister. As you mentioned earlier, just like, you know, getting a food delivery from a supermarket and things like that. But you talk about it being, you felt like a prisoner, you felt claustrophobic, you were cut off, you were isolated. Also, you had a security issue with your phone, so people like me didn't have your phone number anymore.
That was a good thing,
to be fair. But, you know, and there were leaks and things going on. Do you feel that part of the problem we've got in government right now is not just the blob and the civil service and all of that, but actually that we have a presidential-style system unofficially, especially just the prime minister among equals, but a presidential system, but we don't have anything like the support for the man or woman in that top job.
Yes, Completely. I think there are there's two things. One is the government is not structured like that. So the media assume that, and it takes up a huge amount of bandwidth for filling that role. But it's not structured like that. It's still structured as it was before. The second problem is the kind of political and personal support for the Prime Minister, in my view, is not, you know, is not big enough or good enough. And I went in, admittedly, I was in a very difficult position because I hadn't, you know, if you come in from opposition, you've got time to build up a team, et cetera, et cetera. But I still don't think parties are necessarily good at building up the level of that political infrastructure that's required to pursue the kinds of policies. I think the permanent civil service have too much power relative to elected parents. And then there's just the sheer personal stuff, like, you know, things like getting your hair and makeup done, which sound trivial, but you're...
But everyone will comment on it if it's not right.
You're constantly being judged on that stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that it hasn't really caught up with the world as it is
now. The 24/7 media world in particular. No. Just finally, we talked a little bit earlier about, you know wish you, perhaps regret actually becoming Prime Minister and having that legacy.
I don't regret that.
I asked you about that. But you obviously talked in your memoir also about the Queen, of course, Her Majesty dying on your second full day as Prime Minister, saying, you know, why me, why now? You also talk about how she gave you advice and said to you to pace yourself. There's one thing that you could have done differently or done in a different way. What's that one thing while you were in those office, in that office?
I don't think there's anything I could have done that would have changed the outcome. I mean, there were lots of small things that I could have done differently.
You already said you stood by the budget.
Yeah, the contents of it, yes. Obviously, if I'd known that it was a massive tinderbox waiting for us in terms of this liability-driven investments issue, I would have... You know, we should have put pressure on the Bank of England governor to sort that out first. So I suppose that's the biggest thing I didn't know about, that if I'd known about, I would have done something differently.
But no regrets. Je ne regrette rien.
Well, I don't really. And like, I have huge benefits of hindsight. Of course I do. But what I would say, I've learnt a lot. I know that's sad, but I've learnt a hell of a lot about the power of the system, how it works, why, you know, because I always questioned before, you know, why aren't these prime ministers getting on and doing stuff?
It's so frustrating,
and now I know. And what I want to do is use that knowledge to help other Conservatives and people who want to achieve change.
Okay.
Well,
we shall see how that works out. Liz Truss, it's been an absolute pleasure
getting
so much time to talk to you. 10 years to save the West. This is the memoir of our former Prime Minister, Liz Truss. Thank you very much for joining us here on Talk TV.
The Julia Hartley Brewer Podcast. Ruthless but fair. Julia Hartley Brewer. Comprehensive coverage of all the news stories that matter to you.
Harder, older, Hartley Brewer.
The Julia Hartley Brewer Podcast from Talk Radio.